Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I want to start today's conversation with a really specific feeling.
Okay.
It's a feeling I think a lot of us have, but we rarely put a name to it. It's that, you know, that strange, creeping cognitive dissonance you get when you watch the financial news or scroll through the business section.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
Right. You see the charts. And GDP is up, the S&P 500 is breaking records, unemployment is historically low, and the pundits on TV are just popping champagne.
They're telling us the system is working perfectly.
Exactly. But then you turn off the TV and you look out the window.
Mm.
Or you look at your grocery bill. Or you talk to your neighbors about their stress levels.
Yeah.
And things just feel, I don't know, fragile. They feel like they're fraying at the edges.
Yeah, it's what you might call the winning but losing paradox.
Winning but losing.
Right. The scoreboard says we are winning the game, but the players, plus, you know, the actual humans on the field, are exhausted, injured, and running on empty.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And usually when we tackle this kind of disconnect on the deep dive, we look at it through the lens of something specific, like inflation mechanics or supply chain logistics or political polarization.
The mechanics of the game.
Right. But today, we're doing something totally different. We are going way deeper. We aren't looking at the plays on the field. We are looking at the scoreboard itself.
We're asking if the way we keep score is actually killing us.
Yes. It is a fundamental shift in perspective. Mm. And to do this, we are looking at a stack of sources today that are, quite frankly, they are heavy. We are diving into the works of John McMurtry, Jeffrey Noonan, and Jennifer Sumner.
These aren't light beach reads.
No, they are not. I mean, we are dealing with concepts like life value onto axiology.
Hmm.
And I have to admit, when I saw onto axiology in the prep notes, I almost ran for the hills.
I don't blame you.
I thought, great, we're doing a dense philosophy seminar today.
It does sound like academic code, I'll grant you that. But stick with me, because the breakdown is actually very simple and vital. Axiology is really just the study of value, what matters.
Okay.
And ontology is the study of being, what actually exists. So this fancy term is just asking a very grounded question, what actually exists in the real world, and does the way we value things align with that reality?
So it's basically a reality check for our entire value system.
Exactly. The argument these authors make is terrifyingly simple. The economic system we live in isn't just unfair or greedy in a moral sense. It is, by definition, life blind.
Life blind.
Yes. It physically lacks the code to distinguish between creating life and destroying it, just so long as money is moving.
See, that's the hook that got me. The idea that we are running this vital operating system, the global economy, and it is literally missing a line of code. It's missing the code for life.
Right.
So today, our mission is to try and install that code. The sources call it a life value compass.
That is the goal. We want to hand you a tool that lets you look at a news story or a politician's speech or just a product on a shelf and immediately tell if it's building the world up or eating it alive.
And to do that, we have to start by picking a fight.
We do.
Because our sources, they don't hold back. They basically walk into the room and punch the biggest guy in the face. They go straight after John Rawls.
They do go right for the top.
Now, for the listener who hasn't been in a philosophy classroom since their undergrad days or maybe never took one, remind us.
Mm-hmm.
Who is John Rawls and why is he the target here?
John Rawls is the titan of modern political philosophy. If you have discussed justice or liberal democracy in the West any time in the last 50 years, you are playing in John Rawls' sandbox.
Right.
In 1971, he wrote a hugely influential book called A Theory of Justice. And his massive contribution was this idea of fairness as the basis of justice. He came up with this famous thought experiment called the Veil of Ignorance.
I remember this one. The idea is that you imagine you are about to be born into a new society, but you don't know who you're going to be.
Exactly.
You could be born rich, poor, healthy, sick, a genius, or not very bright. You have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And from behind that veil, you have to design the rules of that society.
Right. And Rawls argued that because you are a rational person and you don't want to end up destitute or oppressed, you would design a system where the worst off person is still doing okay. You would want a safety net. You would want what he called primary goods, things like rights, liberties, income, wealth distributed fairly.
Which sounds, you know, totally reasonable. I mean, who argues with fairness? I don't know if I'm going to be the CEO or the janitor. I'm definitely going to make sure the janitor has a decent life. Why do McMurtry and Noonan have a problem with this?
Here is where they come in with the sledgehammer. They argue that Rawls makes a fatal, invisible assumption. He assumes that the goods we are distributing, the income, the wealth, the resources, are automatically good. He focuses entirely on distribution.
How we slice the pie.
Exactly, without ever asking what the pie is actually made of.
Okay, that's an interesting metaphor. Unpack that for a second.
Well, Redis talks about distributing income and wealth as if they are just neutral tokens. But in the real world, where does income come from? It comes from production. It comes from industry. What if the production of that income is destroying the water supply? What if the factory that generates the wealth is pumping carcinogens into the air?
So under Rawls' theory, if we have a factory that poisons the town, but the profits from that factory are distributed fairly to the workers and the poor, then justice has been served.
Precisely. According to Rawls' difference principle, which is his big rule for economic justice, inequality is okay as long as it benefits the least well-off. So if the rich guy running the poison factory gets richer, but the poor guy gets a slightly higher wage because of the factory's success, Rawls says, thumbs up, that is justice.
But the poor guy is getting cancer.
And that is the life blindness. Rawls' theory is completely abstract. It happens in a mathematical void where biology doesn't even exist. He separates the economic good, the money, from the life consequence, which is the pollution, the disease, the exhaustion.
Wow.
Our sources argue that you cannot have a valid theory of justice that ignores the biological reality of the people you are trying to be just to. You can't distribute advantage if the system generating the advantage is literally killing the recipients.
This is the shift from money value to life value. It seems like such a subtle distinction until you really look at it.
It changes everything. It means we have to stop using money as the baseline for reality. We have to use the life ground.
The life ground. That sounds almost religious, but they mean it scientifically, right?
Completely scientific. The life ground of value is the objective reality of what living things need to survive and flourish. It is not an opinion. It is not a political stance. It is the physical connection between a living organism and its environment. McMurtry proposes a new axiom to replace the old economic ones. He calls it the primary value axiom.
This was the dense part in the notes that I had to read three times. X is of value if and only if.
Let's break it down deeply. X is of value if and only if it enables a more coherently inclusive range of thought, experience, and action.
Okay, let's translate that into human.
It means a thing is only good, it only has value if it allows you to be more alive. Does it let you think more clearly? Does it let you feel more deeply? Does it let you act more effectively? If the answer is yes, it has value. If it shuts you down, if it makes you sick, confused, stuck, or dead, it is disvalue. It is bad.
It seems incredibly obvious when you say it that way. Good things make you live better, but the implication is that money in itself has zero value.
Zero. Actually, it can have negative value if it blocks your life capacity. The analogy the text uses is haunting, and I think it really drives this home. Imagine you are locked in a bank vault. You are surrounded by $1 billion in cash, gold bars, bearer bonds, the works. You are unequivocally the richest person in the world,
Right.
but the air vent is blocked.
I have maximum wealth, but I have 10 minutes to live.
In market terms, you are a massive success story. You have assets. You have capital. In life value terms, you are already dead. The market cannot see that you are gasping for air. It only counts the money in the room. That is what life blind means. It isn't a metaphor. The system literally cannot register the loss of life as a negative as long as the assets are preserved.
That vault image is going to stick with me. It creates a completely different way of filtering wants versus needs. And I think this is where we get into the end criterion, right? Because in our culture, the line between want and need is totally blurred. My kids tell me they need a PS5. I feel like I need a third cup of coffee. A billionaire feels like he needs a private jet to get to a meeting on time.
Right. And standard economics validates all of that. In
Right.
economics, we have this term called effective demand. The market defines a need as anything you have the money to pay for. If you want a golden toilet and you have the cash, the market says this is a valid need. And it reallocates society's resources, the gold, the labor, the engineering, to build it. Meanwhile, if 1 million people need antibiotics to stop an infection, but they have no money, the market says there is zero demand for antibiotics.
That is actually insane. When you say it out loud, it sounds like a pathology. We are prioritizing the golden toilet over the life-saving medicine just because of wallet size.
It is a pathology. That's why McMurtry calls the current system the cancer stage of capitalism. It grows for the sake of growth, completely ignoring the host. But the end criterion gives us a scientific way to push back. It states that N is a need if and only if deprivation of it results in a reduction of life capacity.
Okay, let's stress test this. Water.
Simple. Deprivation leads to death, loss of all capacity to think, feel, or act. So water is an absolute need. This is where it gets interesting. A lot of libertarians might say, well, you don't need to read to stay alive. You can eat and breathe without reading. But the life value framework says, no, look at the capacity. If you are deprived of literacy in 2026, does your range of thought and action shrink? Can you navigate the legal system? Can you understand your medical prescription? Can you participate in democracy?
No, your world gets tiny. You are incredibly vulnerable.
Exactly. Your life is smaller. Therefore, literacy is a need. It is a life good.
What about the billionaire's yacht?
Apply the test. If the billionaire is deprived of the yacht, does his capacity to think, feel, or survive actually shrink? Does he become less human? No. In fact, you could argue his life might get deeper without the distraction. So the yacht is a want, not a need. The end criterion cuts right through all that consumerist noise. It forces us to ask, does this thing actually build life, or is it just a shiny object?
There was a section in the readings that applied this exact logic to the right to life debate. And I found it fascinating because it completely sidestepped the usual political shouting match. It didn't feel like it was taking a side in the culture war, but rather analyzing the logic of life itself. And just to be clear to you, the listener, we are impartially reporting the source's philosophical argument here. We aren't endorsing any specific political viewpoint.
Right. Usually that debate is framed as the rights of the fetus versus the rights of the woman. It's a clash of abstract legal rights. But the life value framework asks a very different question. It asks, where is the life ground? Who is the current bearer of the capacity to think, feel, and act?
And the answer, biologically speaking, is the pregnant woman.
Correct. According to the source, she is the one with the fully realized fields of thought, feeling, and action. The argument is that to prioritize a potential life, which has no current capacity for thought or action, over an actual life, which is fully feeling and thinking, is a violation of life coherence. It treats the woman as a vessel, a means, rather than a life in herself.
But the text doesn't let the pro-choice side off the hook either, does it? It's not just a rubber stamp for liberal politics.
No, it doesn't at all. Because if choice is just treated like a consumer preference, like I choose this abortion, like I choose a brand of toothpaste, that's also life blind. The real life value issue is asking what conditions are required to support life. Do we have universal health care? Do we have child care? Do we have economic security? If a woman terminates a pregnancy because she simply cannot afford to feed a child, the authors argue that isn't freedom. That is a massive failure of the collective life support system.
Speaking of that collective life support system, this brings us to the hero of our story today. We've talked a lot about the problem, which is life blindness. Now we need the solution. The sources call it the civil commons.
I love this concept. It is one of those ideas that once you see it, you start seeing it absolutely everywhere. It completely changes how you walk down the street.
When I first read civil commons, I pictured a village green. You know, peasants, sheep, maybe a maypole. It sounds a bit archaic.
That's the historical root of the word. But McMurtry's definition is much broader and much more modern. The civil commons is defined as any cooperative human construction that protects and enables universal access to life goods.
Give us some concrete examples. What are we looking at right now that fits that definition?
A sidewalk outside your house.
A sidewalk. Okay. It's just concrete.
But think about what a sidewalk is conceptually. It is a piece of land that has been intentionally removed from the market. You don't have to pay a toll to walk on it. You don't need a membership card. It is paved with public funds to ensure that anyone, regardless of whether they have a penny in their pocket, can move safely through the community without being run over by a car. That is the civil commons.
Okay, that makes sense. What else?
The airwaves. The fact that you can turn on a radio and hear emergency broadcasts for free. The concept of universal healthcare. That if your body breaks, society fixes it because your life is a value in itself. The fire department. Imagine if the fire department was a private subscription service. Sorry, your subscription lapsed. Good luck with the fire.
We'd think that was barbaric.
Exactly. Because we have established a civil common for fire safety, even standardizing electric plugs is a civil common.
Wait, electric plugs? How does that fit in?
Think about it. Why doesn't your house burn down every time you plug in a toaster? Because we, as a society, agreed on strict safety standards. We created a common rule to protect life. We didn't leave it to the free market to sell safe plugs to the rich and fire hazard plugs to the poor. We made basic electrical safety a universal good.
So it's basically the social immune system.
That is the perfect way to phrase it. Evolution didn't just give us white blood cells to fight bacteria. Social evolution gave us the civil commons to fight off destitution, ignorance, and physical danger.
But wait, I have to play the cynic here for a minute. Because we've all been taught the tragedy of the commons. The idea that if you share something, people will inevitably trash it. If you have a shared pasture, everyone puts too many sheep on it, the grass dies, and everyone starves. Doesn't that prove that the commons model doesn't work and we need private ownership?
I'm so glad you brought that up because the sources take absolute delight in tearing that argument apart. That phrase, tragedy of the commons, comes from a really famous essay by Garrett Hardin in 1968. It's cited in every economics 101 class, but historically, it's complete fiction.
Fiction.
Totally. Yeah. Actual historical commons, like medieval grazing lands or shared forests, were never lawless free-for-alls. They were strictly and carefully regulated by the community. You had clear rules. You can only graze 3 sheep. You can't cut timber in the winter. You must help maintain the fence. People knew that if they destroyed the resource, they died. So they managed it collectively. The tragedy only happens when you deregulate, when you let individual greed run wild without community rules.
So the tragedy of the commons is actually a description of the unregulated market.
Boom. Exactly. When a corporation pumps carbon into the atmosphere because it's free to do so, that is the tragedy of the commons. They are destroying the shared life ground because there are no rules to stop them. The tragedy is what happens when you dismantle the civil commons.
And this sets up the central conflict of our time. The sources describe it as an unseen war.
Yes. The sources argue that for the last 40 years, the era of what we often call neoliberalism, we have been witnessing a systematic war against the civil commons. What is privatization? It's taking a piece of the civil commons, like water or schools or the post office, and enclosing it to extract profit. What is defunding? It's starving the immune system.
We are attacking our own white blood cells.
To feed the tumor?
Let's name the tumor then. We've hinted at it, but let's look at the actual code. The sources call it the money sequence of value. I know this goes back to Marx, but the sources update it for the 21st century.
Right. So the formula for life, the way humans have operated for 99% of our history, is C to M to C, commodity to money to commodity.
I grow apples. That's the commodity. I sell them for cash. That's the money. I use the cash to buy shoes. Another commodity.
The money is just a tool in the middle. The goal is the shoes. The goal is life. The goal is satisfying a human need. But the capitalist sequence is different. It reverses it. It is M to C to M prime. Money to commodity to money prime.
Money prime meaning more money.
Right. You start with $1 million. You build a factory to make a commodity. But the goal isn't the factory, and it certainly isn't the product. The goal is to end up with $2 million. The commodity is just a nuisance in the middle. It's a necessary evil you have to deal with to get to the profit.
And the sources argue we've reached a stage where the system is trying to delete the middleman entirely. M to M prime.
Financialization, speculation, high frequency trading. This is making money purely from money, completely detached from the life ground. It creates a closed loop where money grows itself. And when this code takes over, it creates entities that are legally programmed to be sociopaths.
You're talking about the corporate person.
Yes. We treat corporations as persons under the law. They have rights, they can sue, they can own property, but they are persons with only one single drive. Maximize M prime.
There's a court case mentioned in the text that I had never actually heard of, but it explains so much about how we got here. Dodge versus Ford Motor Company from 1919.
It's the smoking gun of corporate law.
Yeah.
So Henry Ford, who, let's be clear, was no saint, he had plenty of massive historical issues, but in this specific instance, he decided he was making too much money. Ford Motor Company was swimming in cash. He wanted to use his massive profits to lower the price of the Model T so more people could buy them and to pay his workers more. He literally said in court that he wanted to spread the benefits of this industrial system to the greatest possible number to help them build up their lives and homes.
He wanted to invest in the civil commons of his workforce. He wanted to prioritize the life ground.
And the Dodge brothers, who were minority shareholders at the time, sued him. And they said, you can't do that. That money belongs to us. You can't give it away to the workers or the customers. The court sided with the Dodge brothers. And the ruling is chilling. They ruled that a business corporation is organized and carried on primarily for the profit of the stockholders. The powers of the directors are to be employed exclusively for that end.
So wait, if a CEO today has to choose between helping the community and maximizing dividends, the law says he must choose the dividends.
Yes. Legally, the corporation cannot have a conscience if that conscience hurts the bottom line. If being good costs money, it is technically a violation of their fiduciary duty to the shareholders.
So we have a legal system that enforces life blindness. It mandates it from the top down.
Correct. And now, thanks to globalization, we've taken that legal logic and applied it to the whole planet.
You're talking about the investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms. This part terrified me. It sounds like a conspiracy theory you'd read on a weird blog, but it's right there in the treaties.
It should terrify you. These are clauses buried deep in trade treaties like NAFTA or the rules of the World Trade Organization. They allow a corporation to sue a sovereign government if that government passes a law that hurts the corporation's expected profits.
So if a country says, hey, we just found out this agricultural chemical is causing cancer, we're banning it, the chemical company can sue the country.
Yes. They can sue for the profits they would have made if the ban hadn't happened. And these cases aren't heard in public courts with a jury. They're heard in secret tribunals by corporate lawyers acting as arbitrators.
So what happens? Does the country pay?
Sometimes they pay billions. But more often, governments just get scared. It's a phenomenon called regulatory chill. A small country wants to pass a strong environmental law, but they know Philip Morris or Exxon might sue them for $1 billion, so they just don't pass the law. We have created a world where the right to profit overrides the right to life.
It's a coup. A quiet, global, slow-motion coup.
It is the money sequence, fully conquering the life ground. It is the formalization of the idea that money has more rights than living, breathing things.
Let's ground this again. We've been very high level, talking about international law and corporate history. Let's talk about what's in the fridge right now. Part 5 of the notes focuses entirely on the food system.
Jennifer Sumner's work. This is the perfect case study. Food is the ultimate need. You can't opt out. You can decide not to buy a smartphone, but you can't decide not to eat.
And the statistics here are mind-bending. We produce enough food to feed everyone on Earth. We have the sheer calories. Yet 800 million people are starving, and simultaneously, over 1 billion are obese or overweight. How do we screw up the logistics that badly?
We didn't screw up. That's the terrifying part. The system is working exactly as designed. Remember, M to C to M prime. If food is just a commodity to make money, you don't send it to hungry people.
Why not? They need it the most.
Because hungry people usually have no money. They have a biological need, but they don't have effective demand in the market. So the market completely ignores them. The food goes to where the money is, not where the hunger is.
And the obesity crisis. How does that fit in?
That's the other side of the exact same coin. The food industry realized that fresh, raw food life goods like vegetables, fruits, whole grains, has a very low profit margin. Lettuce rots. It's hard to brand a carrot. But pseudofood.
Pseudofood. I love that term.
It's the perfect description. Highly processed, sugar-laden, chemically preserved food-like substances. They are incredibly cheap to make, mostly from subsidized corn syrup and soy. They sit on a grocery shelf for years without spoiling. And crucially, they are engineered in labs to be addictive. They tap right into our evolutionary cravings for salt, fat, and sugar. They are incredibly profitable.
So the system is actively incentivized to create malnutrition. Starvation for the poor globally because they can't pay, and obesity for the rest of us because that's what pays the shareholders.
Sumner argues that the global corporate food system profits directly from reducing life capacity. The diseases caused by this diet, diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, are treated as externalities. The food industry doesn't pay for your insulin or your heart bypass. The civil commons pays for it. Our healthcare systems, our insurance pools, they privatize the profit of the junk food and they socialize the disease it causes.
We see this so clearly in food deserts. I've driven through neighborhoods in major cities where you can buy a spare tire, a gun, or a bottle of whiskey on every single corner, but you cannot find a fresh green apple to save your life.
It's the market speaking loudly and clearly. It says there is no profit in keeping the people in this zip code healthy. So the distribution trucks don't stop there.
So what is the alternative here? We can't just stop eating to protest the system.
We have to treat food as a civil common. We need to start thinking of it as a public utility.
Which sounds, it sounds radical to modern ears. Public food, it makes people think of bread lines or rationing.
Does it really, though? We have public water. We accept that the city should pipe clean, safe water to every single home because it's a biological necessity. We don't say, well, if you can't afford the premium water subscription, you just die of thirst. Why is food any different? Sumner points to the city of Belo Horizonte in Brazil as a shining example of how this actually works.
Tell us about that. How do they do it?
Back in the 1990s, the city government declared that food was a human right, and not just as a nice political slogan, but as an actionable policy. They created these things called people's restaurants that serve healthy, locally grown meals for pennies. They linked local rural farmers directly to the urban consumers, completely cutting out the massive corporate middlemen. They put fresh produce stands in the poorest neighborhoods and subsidized them with city funds.
And what was the result?
Child mortality plummeted. Malnutrition practically vanished. And here is the real kicker for the economists. It cost a tiny fraction of what they were previously spending on treating sick people in hospitals. By prioritizing the end criterion, actual nutrition, over the money sequence, they actually saved money in the long run. But much more importantly, they saved human lives.
It's amazing how solvable these massive, seemingly intractable problems are when you just stop trying to extract a profit from them.
That's the core lesson. The inefficiency we always hear about in public systems is usually just the profit motive getting in the way of the actual solution.
Okay, we have one last piece of the puzzle to look at today. We've talked about consumption, with food and protection, with the commons. But what about action? What are we doing with our days, with our lives? The notes mention this concept of the human vocation.
This is the soul of the whole theory. Right now, most of us view work as a disutility. That's the actual economic term for it. It's an annoyance, a cost you bear to get money. We are called human resources. We are just inputs in the machine.
I sell my time, you give me cash. If I didn't need the cash to pay rent, I wouldn't do the work. It's a purely transactional misery.
But human beings have a deep evolutionary need to be useful, to contribute to the tribe. McMurtry calls this the human vocation. It is the fundamental need to do something of value for others that is also deeply meaningful to oneself.
It reminds me of how people act in disaster zones. When an earthquake hits or a flood destroys a town, nobody asks for overtime pay. Nobody sits down to negotiate a union contract. They just start digging in the rubble. They pass out water. They cook meals for strangers.
Exactly. That is the human vocation breaking through the money code. We naturally want to help. We want to build. The current system forces us to suppress that natural drive every single day. It forces us to ask, does this pay? Before we are allowed to ask, does this help?
And how many people are stuck in what the anthropologist David Graeber called bullshit jobs? Mm-hmm. Jobs where you spend all day marketing junk nobody needs or moving numbers on a spreadsheet to help a billionaire's tax shelter, and you go home feeling totally empty.
Millions and millions of people. That feeling of emptiness isn't a personal failing. It is the structural suppression of your human vocation. A true life value society wouldn't just hand people a welfare check and tell them to stay home. It would give them the opportunity to do work that actually builds the civil commons, to care for the elderly, to restore the wetlands, to teach children, to build resilient infrastructure.
It completely changes the definition of unemployment, doesn't it? Unemployment isn't just not having a job. It's being systematically blocked from contributing to your own world.
Beautifully put. It is a tragic waste of human life capacity.
We've covered a massive amount of ground today. I feel like my brain has been entirely rewired. Let's recap this journey. We started with the abstract philosophy of John Rawls and realized his whole concept of fairness was built on a toxic foundation that ignored biology.
Then we moved to the end criterion, learning to distinguish between the actual biological need for things like water and literacy and the market want for a luxury yacht. We identified the civil commons as the invisible immune system that keeps us alive, the sidewalks, the public libraries, the safety regulations.
And we looked the enemy right in the eye, the money sequence of value, the viral code that values profit over life, enforced by legal structures like the corporate person and those secret trade tribunals.
We saw exactly how this plays out on our dinner plates with the global food system, creating starvation and obesity side by side because profit demands it.
You know, it's so easy to feel overwhelmed by all this. The economy feels like the weather. It's just this massive storm that happens to us, and we feel incredibly small and powerless.
That helplessness is the intended effect of the system. It wants you to feel passive. It wants you to be just a consumer, not an active citizen. But the life value compass cuts right through that fog. The next time you hear a politician propose a new policy or a CEO announce a corporate initiative, you just have to ask one simple question. Does this enable more inclusive thought, feeling, and action? Or does it shut it down?
Does this build the civil commons, or does it sell it off to the highest bidder?
Once you have that lens, you truly can't unsee it, and you stop being confused by the winning but losing paradox we talked about at the start. You realize that any economic growth that kills the planet isn't growth at all, it's suicide.
So here is our final challenge to you, the listener. Today, when you walk out your front door, I want you to actively look for the civil commons. Don't just ignore the sidewalk under your feet. Really look at it. Look at the public library. Turn on your tap and look at the clean drinking water.
Realize that these things are not accidents of nature. They're hard-won victories. They were fought for by people who prioritize life over profit. They are the result of choices. And right now, they are under siege.
The question you have to answer is this. Are you just going to be a passive passenger riding on the civil commons? Or are you ready to find your human vocation and defend it?
Because the civil commons is the only thing standing between us and the total collapse of the life ground. It's up to us to keep the roof up.
Now that is a deep dive. Thank you for taking this journey with us. Take care of your life ground, and we'll see you next time.